Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The unconventional family has always been with us, even as Ozzie and Harriet ruled the television version of the nuclear family in the 1950s and 60s. It was losing its grip on reality. Now the unconventional family is the Ozzie and Harriet version. University of San Francisco sociologist and author Joshua Gamson has written on the topic through a series of stories about the new versions of family. His new book is entitled Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
You say that the stories you tell in the book are about real people, real families, are deeply personal, but also unavoidably political. How so?
Well, I mean, first of all, these are stories from my own life and from people I know. So when I say that they're intimate and personal, I mean that literally. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, my kids, my friends' kids, and so on. But what I mean about the political part is that everyone makes a family in the midst of some form of political circumstance. So, you know, whether that is, in my case, as a gay man having to deal with the politics of same-sex marriage and the politics of same-sex family making, you know, who's allowed to make a family, who's not allowed to make a family. That's all political in the sense of people are battling out who gets to do what and what the resources are that are available to people. But, you know, that's true also for things that look like conventional family making, when women decide about reproduction, that's shaped by their access to contraception, to health care, and so on. That's shaped by the politics of gender that they're in, you know, who parents and so on. So that's just for me, it's a basic fact of family making that was a starting point for telling these stories.
You know, you're an academic, you're a sociologist. Why did you decide to make it personal?
Partly I decided to make it personal because it was so personal to me. You know, it started out for me as, you know, I don't know, from love. You know, I didn't realize that when we had our first baby, I would also be sort of hormonal and, you know, crying a lot,
feeling
all these things. And, you know, at that point I said, I have to get this on paper. You know, this was such a loving process. In our case, both of our kids involved a lot of people because, you know, we're missing some of the body parts required for reproduction and so on. So, you know, it was very personal for me. And then it was also really about other people's curiosity, and I discovered very early on that people were really, you know, at first I thought it was rude. People would ask a lot of questions about our family, like, you know, they'd see us with a baby, where did you get her, that kind of thing. And I thought, well, that's rude.
Well, you tell a really great story and make that clear that this isn't just for people who are members of these new kinships. You tell the story about the clerk in the jewelry store in Santa Fe, and I love that story.
Yeah. So, yeah, and this is what I was trying to get across, too, is that so we were Reba, our first child, was maybe 3 or 4 months old, and I was at a conference in Santa Fe, and we were walking around, and one too many people asked us, where did you get her? And my husband actually kind of lost it a little bit and started, you know, I don't know, asserting himself about why do you ask that? What kind of question is that? Would you ask that of other people? Mm-hmm. And then she started to cry, and it became clear that
the clerk,
the woman, I think she was the proprietor of the store, and she just started to cry in the store. And I took the baby outside because she was crying, and I watched as Richard and she sort of connected around what her question was really about, which was her own sense of, you know, she had wanted to have a child, was not able to, was remarried, her new husband, something like that. Her new husband didn't want to have a child. So she was sort of, I don't know, identifying with us, trying to figure out how did we do this thing that she wanted to do. And that really turned my attitude around, my attitude towards what I was doing and towards the questions that people were asking me. And I realized that a lot of times it's curiosity. It may come across as, you know, to me as impertinent, but it's curiosity, interest, and sometimes identification with us. And I thought, all right, I can tap into that curiosity. I can address that curiosity with stories, with actual stories of what it's like to do this, with the intimate details of how it works, with different types of stories, you know, different types of family making stories that are unusual, because I knew so many people who were doing it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about unconventional families, which is not really as unconventional might suggest. My guest is Joshua Gamson. He's a sociologist from the University of San Francisco. He's written a new book. It's entitled Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. If you have a question or a comment, if you'd like to share your own story of unconventionality, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post your comment there. Tell us about your family. In her foreword to your book, Melissa Victoria Harris Perry, the writer, professor, television host, and political commentator, she wrote that she needed your book as a guide through the personal choices and political implications of her own family. She said the book is not a roadmap, but a companion for all those who choose to navigate the world of modern kinship. I thought that was an interesting way to put it.
I love that, because I really felt like she got what I was doing when she wrote that. Because I wasn't, I'm not trying with this book to be sort of I don't know. It's not a how-to book exactly. It's not a critique of, you know, these forms of family making exactly. It really is meant to be, this is what it feels like to do this. This is what it's, what the experience is from the inside. And it's a complicated, mixed experience, because it's, of course, very, very beautiful to make a family, to have this dream of, you know, loving and being loved. That is very universal, I think, and trying to pursue that against a lot of obstacles. All of these families faced a lot of obstacles and had to be very deliberate about the process, very conscious about the process, amass resources usually. And, you know, at the same time, there's all of these troubling issues along the way that, you know, if you're doing surrogacy, there's how you respond to the fact that this is a commercial process. If you're doing adoption, there's you know, a lot of issues about your relationship to a birth family and to the history of that child and to the culture that they're coming from, and to the fact that a lot of times a child is parentless or you know, up for adoption because of circumstances that are really messed up. So when Melissa Harris Perry talked about it being a roadmap, I think that's what she was referring to, that it's really meant to be sort of, this is what it looks like from, you know, when you go through it. This is what the terrain looks like.
You and I were talking earlier off the air, and you said that even as you started to write, or when in the midst of writing the book, you know, the distance, time, things had changed even during that time, that it wasn't as unusual, that we'd kind of turned a corner in the era.
Yeah, and in this country, in certain, you know, in parts of this country, but now in this country, in terms of the Supreme Court decision about same-sex marriage, certainly in that area, things changed so rapidly. So when I started out, you know, I really started recording the story when Reba was born, our oldest child, and she's going to be 10 in January, so it's a while ago. And at that point, we actually got married in Massachusetts, when Massachusetts was the only place where it was legal for us to be married. And it felt like we were doing something so momentous and radical, you know, at the time, even though it was also, you know, getting married, which is not the most radical act in the world. but, you know, it was definitely, you know, we would go to the next state over and we wouldn't be married anymore. And, you know, to get our kids recognized as our kids took a lot of legal maneuvering and so on. And that's shifted so dramatically in the last decade that by the time I was finishing the book with all of the stories, I started to think of it as kind of a snapshot of a moment in time when things were changing in major ways in this area of family making.
It's something anthropologists will be look back on.
Yeah, exactly. And hold on, one of my kids just came in. No, okay. Sorry, not available.
Great dad.
That's conventional family making. So now it's kind of a moment in time. And, I mean, there's still a lot of change to happen. So, you know, a lot of change to be made.
You know, you note and make the point, and it's so true, that so much of the discussion about family to begin with is based on a nostalgia for the way we never were, like Ozzie and Harriet. But despite the fact that it's myth, it's still terrifying to some people to move outside of those boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, that phrase, the way we never were, comes from a book title of a great historian, Stephanie Kuntz. That's not my phrasing, that's hers. The fact that there never was this mythical family of two, you know, a married couple and a couple of kids and so on, that Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver kind of image, does not mean that the idea of that wasn't powerful, and it still is really powerful. It still is the norm against which other families are measured. So it still is seen by most people, for interesting reasons, seen as by most people as the way things most normally are, the way things often, I think for many people, the way things should be. So when you move away from that, people get, I think disoriented in some ways, sometimes more than that, sometimes angry that the way they think things must be is being shifted. And that's true, you know, in any major social change. But I try to distinguish in the book between the mythical, the idea that this has not actually ever been the way all families were, and the power of that myth that this is what a normal family looks like.
A long time ago, when I was getting my start in journalism, I wrote a series of vignettes, and the headline was something to the effect of women who choose to be single parents, which was really important. You talk about the idea of intentional versus unintentional. What difference does it make?
Intentional and unintentional.
I should say deliberately unconventional versus non-deliberately unconventional.
What difference does – I'm sorry, I'm not
what
sure I'm
What difference
following.
Does the deliberation of it make in your mind?
So in my mind, first of all, I want to say that I think that all families are intentional at some point and on some level. Mm-hmm. So I was wary of saying, like, you know, these are intentional families.
Gotcha.
And people who,
okay,
you know, because I do think there's a point at which if, you know, for instance, if you become pregnant, you do have a decision to make. And there's intention in that, even if you didn't plan that pregnancy. And most people, you know, I think are planning. But in terms of the deliberateness, you know, one of the things that strikes me about all of these families that I'm writing about is how much we all had to want it, because there were so many difficulties in getting there, and how inventive we all had to be to get there. And that's something that makes, I think, these stories really, it's part of the beauty of these stories, as, you know, sort of unusual as they are, as convoluted as the process was, is that, you know, we really, what's so beautiful about it is that we had to work so hard and think so much about what we were doing along the way.
Versus just falling into the proposal, the wedding, it's all out there for you. The template's obvious.
Right. And I think, yes, the template and the script are obvious for most people, and they're easy, and you follow the path. Not everybody does it that way. It's mm-hmm. not that everybody just is sort of mindless about it, but mm-hmm. it's very easy when, you know, and I have areas of my life where the script is there for me, and I just kind of follow it. I mean, my work life is like that. I'm not doing sort of, you know, rewriting the whole way of doing work. So it's just, this is an area where for some of us, it had to be, out of necessity, had to be very creative, inventive, deliberate, and I would say sort of super mindful along the way. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about modern families, inspired by the book Modern Families, Story of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. My guest is Joshua Gamson. He's a sociologist with the University of San Francisco. If you have a question or comment, want to share the story of your own extraordinary journey to kinship, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Modern Families today, not exactly the television show Modern Family, which began airing in 2009, but stemming from that idea that the modern family has many iterations. University of San Francisco sociologist and author Joshua Gamson has written a new book on the topic entitled Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. He joins us by phone. As you noted in your book, Joshua, Modern Family has won more than 100 major awards, including 57 Emmy Awards and Best Comedy Emmy for 5 years in a row. You said family diversity is not just visible, it gets awards. Those are your words.
Right.
What did you make of the show when it first came out?
You know, I've always enjoyed that show because that part of life was not that visible on TV. The different kinds of families, intergenerational couples and same-sex couples and so on. I appreciated it just for the humor of it, and I appreciated it for the new visibility that is now not that new,
right,
of family diversity. And it is part of what's behind this book because, you know, my book's really about the making of the families, and I think that's the part that's not all that visible. And on that show, for instance, you know, it's just basically this family diversity is kind of the setup for the humor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think still it raises people's awareness that there's all kinds of different kinds of family structures now, but they still don't know a lot about the way that you get there.
You told a story, I think it was chapter 3, about Aldo
mm-hmm.
and his mother's. You had some preconceived notions about where he came from and how it worked, and you kind of learned something that it's not always what it seems.
Right. Yeah. Which was, I was a little bit arrogant. I thought, I know everything about how this works. So they were actually neighbors of ours when we first moved back to Oakland from New York, and two women, a female couple, and one of them was pregnant. And I just assumed that they were making their baby the way most of the lesbians I knew around here and in my life have done, which is through donor insemination. And as I got to know them, I found out that they had done something much more complicated and actually much more similar medically to what we had done, which was use in vitro fertilization. So they had a sperm donor, the egg of one of the women, did the in vitro fertilization, and then implanted that embryo into the body of the other woman, which was another very creative way of getting something that they wanted, which was something was very important to them to have some sort of biological relationship to the child, which is important to some people and not to others.
There are lots of different iterations. Can you talk about, could you have gone on and on in writing this book?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because the book just came out, and when as I'm starting to talk to people about it, everybody has a story. You know, I'm newly at this, meeting a lot of new people at a center at Stanford where I am this year. And people just kept coming up to me saying, you know, my daughter is pregnant with her female partner. And, you know, so-and-so is about just adopted twins from Thailand. There are so many, many, many stories. And it's one of the reasons that I liked doing this in a really more focused, narrow way, that I could really get into detail in stories that would, I hope be triggers for other people telling their stories. stories of family creation, because there's a fair amount of, still for all the visibility of family diversity, the creation of kids in these unconventional ways still has a bit of a veil around it. And so, you know, yeah, I could go on and on. There's so many stories.
Well, I love the opening cartoon in your introduction, a child getting tucked into bed by her two dads. And she says, "Tell me my origin story."
Yeah.
And
I
we
love
all
that
have
too.
One. And we do love to say, "Tell me about the date that, you know, my mom," I'm a middle child of five, so she can't remember. But when I was born, I'm the one that's forgotten. But, you know, do you remember when I was born? What happened that day? That kind of thing. Why is that important to us? Put on your sociologist hat.
Yeah, I mean, and that's maybe a psychologist question, too.
Yeah.
I think everybody wants to know where they came from, you know, and I think it's very important for kids in particular, and this is something I thought about before we had kids. It's very important for them to know that they came into the world the way everybody else came into the world, especially for kids who are in some sort of less than conventional family, whether it's even, you know, a single parent, or, you know, two parents of the same sex, or four parents, or, you know, I think it's important emotionally for people to know where they came from, just in terms of roots, but also for kids to know how they came into the world. And the funny thing about that cartoon for me is that, you know, at the beginning of this book, each of these stories is so elaborate. And when I think about my own, you know, if that was me in the cartoon saying, "Tell me my origin story," my parents would, you know, it's a 5-sentence story or something. The way most of us who came into the world in a more
right.
conventional manner, you know, it's, you know, I was late, they were having a party, and then I decided to come, and then they toasted at the party, kind of like that.
Uh-huh.
And then I look at my own kids, and these stories are, you know, can fill a book.
So how do you decide what to tell them?
That is a really good and difficult question, because there isn't agreement necessarily among the adults. And in my family, there isn't full agreement about how to approach it with the kids. I personally think you know, there are age-appropriate ways of telling the truth. For everything, and that includes these kind of complex origins. I don't think there's much gain in keeping things hidden or mystified or anything like that. So my approach is to sort of treat it as a set of just facts. And there are some things that I'm gonna say later on. The complexities of egg donation and sperm donation, which are, you know, behind each of our kids. Mm-hmm. One of us is the sperm donor for each kid, and then they each come from a different egg donor. And that's a hard thing to explain. I'm going to wait until they're you know, interested in how reproduction works.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are books that people send us that I find that are starting to address this for kids about, you know, just the facts of reproduction, and this is where you fit in, and this is who was involved. But it's complicated, because the more people you have involved, the more feelings there are around what's private, what's not private, and so on.
Hmm.
And that's one of the things I write about towards the end of the book, is the just sort of the complications of storytelling.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the modern family. My guest is Joshua Gamson. He's a sociologist from the University of San Francisco. He writes about himself and many other families in his book, Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, one of the big political issues that you wrote about is that non-traditional families are not found just among the well-to-do liberal, but that there is a larger trend among that ilk, that education, finances, social standing have a lot to do with who can pursue these kinds of things and who can't.
Right. And I would really, really like to see that change. I mean, I think we really need to figure out in this country how to make reproduction and family making more available to more people. But at this stage, that has to do primarily with the fact that it's very expensive to do. You know, we did surrogacy arrangements, which are costly, and we, not everyone is positioned. You know, we're a professor and a doctor, great. You know, we're month to month paycheck, but okay. Mm-hmm. But you know, we're going to be paying off those debts for probably the rest of our lives. But we had the capacity to borrow money. We had, you know, my parents could help a bit. And that's the scene when it comes to surrogacy, because it's basically privately financed. So that means that the people who are able to do that have to have those resources. And so it's sort of it's one of those things in the roadmap that makes it complicated. It's true for certain forms of adoption as well, that they're costly. And then there's just the sense that some people have that others don't, that this is, you know, I'm entitled to this, that I can have a dream of family that's difficult to do, and I can figure out how to get there, and I have the sort of the right, and that's not distributed equally across the population either.
Aliyah, you're in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Aliyah.
Hi, Anne.
Or I should say Aliyah, sorry.
It's okay. People mess it up all the time.
Go ahead, tell us your story.
Well, I am a mother and a stepmother in a blended family. And when I met the father of my stepchild, she's around 6 or 7 months old. And I just wanted to comment on how really mindful you do have to be when being in an unconventional family, especially since people are so caught up in the traditional sense, which is, I'm sure, what her parents imagined it would be for her and for them. But it didn't turn out that way, and how you have to be loving in order to attain that security for your child and for your own family. I also appreciate your guest, because it's incredibly comforting to know that there are so many different kinds and versions of family, and that you do not have to have a traditional style type of family to be one. And that's all I really wanted to say.
Thank you for that comment. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Aliyah.
Thank you.
Take care. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a question or comment, want to share a little bit about your story, we'd love to hear it. What about the issue of adoption, Joshua Gamson? It's very common now, the overseas adoptions and that sort of thing. But they raise different kinds of questions too, don't they?
They do. And the stories, there's a couple of adoption stories in the book, and I was very intentional about wanting to mix up the types of family making that people went through, adoption, surrogacy, and so on. But they raise different kinds of issues. So, you know, it sort of somewhat, again, depends on who you are. So there's countries where single women are not allowed to adopt, many of them. There's many places, of course, where same-sex couples are not legally allowed to adopt. So some of those are just, you know, those are the legal issues around adoption. Mm-hmm. There's also really, especially I think with transnational adoption, with adoption from overseas, a lot of times people are going to get a baby, basically, to adopt a baby from a country that is war-torn or is economically in trouble, and that's the genesis of their family. And so, you know, adoption almost always involves some loss of somebody else's loss. Mm. And I think that's a very, you know, and that's a fact of it. Your joy is tied to someone else's loss. And that's a hard thing, I think, for people to integrate into their life and into their story. And I think, you know, sometimes people want to push that away. They don't want to talk about the country of origin. Sometimes people go the sort of opposite direction. They want to do as much cultural education about the country of origin, but still the loss that this family started with can be, I don't know, I use the word haunting. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it came across in some of the stories of my friends.
an increasing trend in this country is grandparents raising grandchildren as family.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't write about that in this in this book, but that's another form where you mean the original parent is out of the picture.
Right.
Yeah, and you know it's interesting because when you look at family diversity kind of curricula in schools, which is something I'm aware of now more because my kids are in elementary school, that's starting to be one of the things that people talk about. I think it originally started with kind of let's make sure that kids who are coming in with two moms or two dads, like, you know, in my family, that they people understand, people have respect, people, you know, do not bully or tease and so on, that's where the impulse was. But now other forms of non-traditional families are also being integrated into those curricula, including that what you're describing of grandparents raising a child.
Your stories come from people you know. They come from your ilk. They come from, that means the Bay Area. Thoughts about people experiencing a lot of these same sorts of challenges, embarking on these same sorts of kinships in other parts of the country where it might not be as accepted, where there may be no curricula at all?
Yeah, I think that's a very important part, very important point that, you know, regardless of whether there are curricula for the families once they get there, the part of the story that I'm writing about in the book is the creation of the family. Mm-hmm. And it's much harder to do that, I think, in places where you don't have models of it. You don't see other families like that, so you know what you might be in for, and you might have legitimate concerns about what your kids might be in for, not because you're doing something wrong or even think you're doing something wrong, but because of other people's perceptions of what's normal. And you know, I intentionally we took a job in the Bay Area thinking we're going to have a family, and I don't want to do that just anywhere. And I don't want to, you know, assume that there's only a few safe spaces. I bet I could do it in Columbus.
I think you probably could.
There are lots of places.
Sure.
So it's not dire circumstances or differences. But I knew that there were safer places and less safe places, places mm-hmm. where my kids would not be the only one. And even here, they are the only, as far as I know, the only kids with two dads in their pretty large elementary school. There are other kids with two moms, and other kids with, you know, kids with single parents and grandparents and so on. So they're solo in some ways and not in other ways. But that's even here. So I would really like to see us get to a point where it is loosened enough for people that when they want to make a family, they can make a family where they are without fear, without having to do all of this calculating about are they going to have to protect their child from other people's responses? And are they legally protected, which is a very important piece of it. You know, we were more legally protected in California, and then, you know, one of our kids was born in Kentucky, and you know, I write about this in detail about the legal situation once we got to Kentucky, and we left the hospital without a baby who was legally parentless, our second daughter Maddie at that moment, and it took us months to get a birth certificate. So those kind of things differ across the country as well and affect people's decision making.
We're talking about the modern family. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Tell us what it means to you, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about modern families today, what that means and where the notion is headed. My guest is the author of a new book on the topic, Joshua Gamson. His book is entitled Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. Joining us now is probate, estate planning, and adoption attorney, Tommy Tanef. Welcome to the show, Tommy.
Good morning, Ann.
You have devoted much of your career since 1989 to helping people through the unconventional, right? When did you start to see a change in how your clients perceive the idea of family?
It's really a continual evolution. We've pretty much noticed significant changes, I think, probably within the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah. And what has been the biggest change?
I had a young set of birth parents come to my office and specifically state that they only wanted to place their baby with a same-sex couple.
And why? Did you ask them?
No. Sometimes as a lawyer, I don't think it's my job to ask too many personal questions.
Uh-huh.
The conclusion that I came to was that it's different, Anne, than when you and I, and your guest is Jason?
Joshua.
Joshua. I think it's different from when you and I were in high school and how the society compares to our kids now that are in high school. You know, the alternative lifestyle is just something that's just insignificant. It basically doesn't matter to a lot of the young kids. Yeah, so what? No big deal.
Yeah, you tell some pretty funny stories, Joshua, and we've all had them now. By now, we've met some kid. They ask a simple question like, why is it two women? And we get all worked up and we're going to explain it. And they're like, okay, so when's the cake coming?
You know, yeah, I love kids. That's the way it is with them with these stories. And I think Mr. Tanef is right that it's just so dramatically different for young people coming up now to see, you know, lots of different kinds of difference, but certainly sexuality and same-sex families and so on as a sort of shrug of the shoulders. But littler kids will ask you anything, you know. And, you know, why doesn't she have a mom is a very common one for our kids. And, you know, I'll start to explain and they'll get bored and run off.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, that's promising for me.
Yeah, right. What have been some of your biggest legal hurdles, Tommy Tanef, when it comes to unconventional?
Well, up until recently, a same-sex couple, only one could adopt. So now that changes. So now all the process changes, the forms change. But until then, only one could adopt. And as I listened out in the reception area, and Joshua, by the way, please call me Tommy as well, if I can call you Joshua.
Sure thing.
I heard about the fact that, you know, with international adoption, some countries don't recognize this option. And until recently, Ohio didn't recognize this option. So,
yeah, and we were advised when we first started the surrogacy process, what we did legally with both children was a pre-birth order designating us as the legal parents. It still was, you know, not always recognized because it's state by state and so on, so Kentucky gave us a hard time. But we were also advised to do another layer of legal protection of second-parent adoption or step-parent adoption proceedings, which we basically said we wouldn't do because we didn't want to adopt our own kids. And that seems to be, you know, no longer it's no longer so many obstacles to being the legal parent of the child that you from the beginning intended to be legal. You know, everybody agreed was your legal child.
Right. But unfortunately, with our laws just until recently recognizing same-sex marriage, the problem that you are going to run into is when you have one partner that is the adoptive parent, then the only alternative legal option is to do a subsequent step-parent adoption.
Right. But at least that's an option now.
Correct.
Right. Illegally, a child can still have no more than two legal parents, though, right?
Correct.
And that can be an issue. Has it been an issue for you, Tommy? And do you see that changing?
The forms have been changed, and the probate courts are ready.
They're ready for it. Joshua Gamson, people might think, four parents, what's the point?
Well, there are a few responses to that. I mean, so I do. There's a story in the book of one family that is two moms and two dads by intention, and they actually they have two girls who were adopted internationally, one from India and one from Nepal, and they're raising them all together in two separate households. So the, you know, it's an interesting model because it's kind of a you know, like divorced custody arrangement, but without all the animosity.
Yeah.
And, you know, from my perspective as a parent, the more people you have, the more adults you have involved, the better. It's there's so much labor involved in parenting and so much day to day that, you know, I can really see why that's an appeal for people. And for, you know, in that particular story that I was describing, I think some of it was the moms wanting to build into their family structure, build men into the family structure. And for some people, that's very important. And if you're a same-sex female couple, that's one of your options. And I think people are sort of freaked out by the idea of more than two parents. But I think that may be changing too, slowly.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that we're having this conversation, but I think we're going back and forth, and rightfully so, between the surrogacy process and the adoption process. You know, with the adoption process, almost all of the adoptions that I see now are open.
Right.
And when I started practicing almost 30 years ago, everything was closed. And then it evolved into semi-open. Now almost all my adoptions are open adoption. And the level and degree of openness varies, but typically openness involves communication and contact after the placement, after the adoption. But I also tell my prospective adoptive parents or clients that open adoption isn't a shared parenting situation. It's not a co-parenting situation. It's simply recognizing the fact that there are biological parents. And believe it or not, you know, ladies and gentlemen that are listening out there, most birth parents who place a baby for adoption, they don't want to place the baby for adoption and say, here you go, goodbye, see you later, leave me alone. It's quite the opposite. Most of the birth parents that I work with want that contact. They want that information. They don't want to show up on your doorstep. They don't want to help babysit or tell you how to parent the child. They simply don't want to be forgotten. It's that simple.
And there's a legal way to achieve that now.
Well, it's a moral commitment under Ohio law. Under Ohio law, you are allowed to do an open adoption. You are allowed to have contact after the adoption, but neither party can force the other party to continue that relationship or dialogue. I'll tell you what I find on occasion problematic is where the adoptive parents want the contact and the child is old enough to recognize the contact. And then, like many, many birth parents, they kind of move on. That's tough. That's tough on the adopted child. Or the folks have two adopted children, and one of the adopted kids has contact with the bio parents, and the other doesn't. And so the other child is saying, well, why do I not have this contact?
You know, whenever you establish these contacts, whether it's legal or emotional, Joshua Gamson, I mean, it comes down to the kids and how they feel about it growing up and how things can change.
Yeah, and the adults being, you know, very conscious of that, that, mm-hmm. you know, if you're committing, this is true across the board, whether it's, you know, some unconventionally created family or very conventionally created one that changes, that, you know, families of divorce and so on, the contact gets very complicated, right, for kids and for others. But I think, you know, one of the interesting things about what we're seeing with the move to open adoption is that there is an expansion of the idea of who's in your family. There is a change in the idea of who's kin. And with that, hopefully comes a certain kind of commitment. It's interesting that it's legally a moral commitment.
Yeah,
but with or without the law, there's that moral commitment to these are the people in the life of this child. These are the people that are kin. And we are going to work to maintain some form of contact. It doesn't always work out that way, but that's what the commitment is.
And I agree with you, Joshua, because, you know, you have two sets in a typical relationship or situation. You have two sets of grandparents. What's wrong with having three or four sets of grandparents. You also have many non-adopted families where one set of grandparents is significantly more involved with the child, the grandchild, or the family, and some of the grandparents have no involvement. So I tend to agree with you. The more hands-on, the more family to love this child, I think the better the results are.
Joe in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Interesting topic we have here, and I think, you know, different, but you go back four decades, and divorce was still stigmatized, and the children of divorced parents still felt that. Mm-hmm. And I think I was one of them. I remember in grade school, you know, the kids that had a two-parent home, mom and a dad, and that you felt a little bit like an outcast. Didn't really get made fun of for it or any bullying or anything like that, but it still was significant at that time. Of course, now it's really much less of a stigmatization. But I think, you know, it's nice that we have people who want to have children, adopt, care for them, love them, and they're very capable. But I still, somewhere deep inside, I feel like, you know, the old nuclear family is still maybe what's best, even though it doesn't mean it can't be done otherwise.
Yeah, and we talked about that, Joshua Gamson, early on, that even though the nuclear family in and of itself is kind of a myth.
Yes,
in terms of being the most successful.
Right. So one, you know, response to the caller is, what, you know, is that nostalgia, or is that a real thing that we should try to implement or try to protect, that nuclear family that you're describing? And I think that's a lot of people's gut sense, that the best situation for a child is to be raised by a man and a woman in a stable, intact household, preferably a man and a woman who are romantically involved. And that's there's a lot of research to show that that is not the thing that affects children's positive outcomes, and that if you shift a little bit and pivot a little bit, what really seems to make the most difference, and I can provide some of this research, I don't want to just you take my word for it, the biggest danger to kids in this country is probably poverty, not single parents or gay parents or the lack of a male female two parent household. It's poverty.
Joe, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. We just have just about 2 minutes left, and I didn't want to let this go, Tommy Tanef, without bringing up the fact that you adopted a child from China. You had your own experience. That's after years of helping other people adopt. But you probably learned a thing or two that you can't learn from just being a lawyer, that you learned from being a parent.
True. And, you know, the old saying is that, you know, people often question whether or not they'll get involved with adoption. And they say, how could I possibly love a child that's not biologically mine? Well, let me tell you, it exists.
Yeah. And another issue I wanted to, Joshua Gamson, before I let you go, and I'm rushing you, I know I am, but not every family is successful, and the same is true for unconventional families. Is there an extra pressure for success, extra trauma when there's failure?
I don't think that's known yet. I mean, I don't know it as sort of a researcher. Mm-hmm. Personally, I do feel that. I do feel some extra pressure because, you know, if we're sort of the only two-dad family around, I do feel a pressure to be successful at it and a good model. And mm-hmm. I think as more people are making unconventional families, that pressure will dissipate quite a bit.
Well, Joshua Gamson, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Joshua.
Joshua Gamson, he's the author of a new book. It's entitled Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. And Columbus Central Ohio lawyer Tommy Tanef, thanks to you as well for joining us.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me on again.
Appreciate it. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shia Lynette. And thanks to you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.